honored to appear on this panel and to have the opportunity to talk to you about a small corner of the overall issue of how we make the trade-off between secrecy and national security, and which is the issue of fiscal transparency, and in particular to argue that we have not had fiscal transparency regarding the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. I'd like to begin by just thanking my co-panelists, and in particular to say how much, like a whole generation of scholars, I've been inspired by the courage of Daniel Ellsberg for really not only for making information available, but for raising for the next generation the question of how we make these trade-offs and trying to really understand what it is that is required to be secret in order for us to be secure. My own research, as I said, has focused on a small corner of this, but I'm going to make three points this morning, which are part of a larger paper and book project that I presented at Joe Stiglitz's Festschrift, celebrating his 50 years in October. The three points that I'd like to raise this morning are, first of all, that despite the global push for transparency that has led more than 100 countries to enact right-to-information laws, and for the U.S. to enact a number of laws over the past two decades and to be very much a leader in terms of nominal transparency concepts, we've had no effective fiscal transparency in Iraq and Afghanistan, to the point that we still don't understand how much has been spent in these efforts or where the money has been spent. Second, I'm going to propose that this was the result of three factors that reinforced each other. A low public engagement, paying for the wars in a way that circumvented all the regular checks and balances in the budget system, and a failure of the accountability system. The third, I will argue that the absence of fiscal transparency matters, and that it's not possible to have real transparency over national security without fiscal transparency. And that in this case, it led to a number of negative outcomes, including low accountability for government spending, high profiteering, corruption, and waste, poor provision for military veterans, and a widening gap between those who fought in the wars and the rest of us. Let me just start by saying that no one actually knows how much the U.S. has spent in Iraq and Afghanistan to this date. Estimates range from about $1.8 trillion to $5.5 trillion. But to quote the Congressional Research Service, and I quote here, quote, even taking into account the known factors, such as operating tempo of the war, the size of the troop force, and the use of equipment and weapons, none of these factors appear to be enough to explain the size of and continuation in increases in cost. Or, to quote from the GAO, neither the Defense Department nor Congress can reliably know how much the war is costing and details of how appropriated funds are being spent. As you know, Joe Stiglitz and I attempted to figure this out in 2008, and we, using a simple taxonomy for estimating the resources consumed in the war that added direct costs, such as military operations, plus indirect costs at the Pentagon, such as increased recruiting costs, as well as long-term costs, such as disability benefits for veterans. Through that process, we filed more than 400 FOIA requests. We evaluated more than 600,000 individual veterans' disability claims. And we researched thousands of individual line items around helicopter component parts and a great deal of other details. Despite that, I would say that we were left with more questions than answers. And even at the end of all of that process, we still to this day continue to receive letters from military veterans and troops stationed in Afghanistan and elsewhere around the world, inevitably mentioning other costs that we missed. So the question is, how did it happen? How did it happen that in the longest and most expensive wars in U.S. history, the costs have been effectively hidden from public view, despite all of the nominal improvements of the past half century in transparency laws, despite FOIA laws and sunshine laws and the efforts of the Federal Funding Accountability Act, which was actually signed by President Bush in 2006. That was the thing that established the USAspending.gov website, and President Obama, who pledged that his administration would be the most open in history. I will argue that there were at least three factors that reinforced each other that were responsible. First, the public really has not been engaged. The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are the first major conflicts fought entirely by a combination of the all-volunteer force and private contractors. In addition, these wars are the first wars that have been paid for entirely by deficit spending. Which means that current taxpayers have not paid any of the costs. The costs have been deferred to the next generation. This, I will argue, has made the war costs effectively invisible to current citizens. It's also historically unprecedented. In all previous U.S. wars, taxes were raised, in many cases quite considerably. The top income tax was 77% after World War I and 91% after World War II. But as we know, top tax rates were cut twice during the current wars. So it's not surprising that the wars have occupied a smaller and smaller percentage as measured in the so-called news poll over the years, and that opinion polls show that every year since the invasion of Iraq, the public has a less and less accurate command of details such as the number of casualties and the number of troops who were deployed. I believe that I'm trying to outline this three-pronged idea of the low public engagement, which came from not fighting and not paying, and arguing that the second point here, the blue box, was something that was sort of enabled by the low public engagement, but it was a complete breakdown of the normal budgetary process. So Richard previously described that the Defense Department, at least in theory, has a very open budget process. But in fact, we have paid for the wars almost entirely bypassing the regular budgetary process, circumventing the budget caps, enacting large amounts of deferred spending, financing entirely through debt, enacting funding bills at different times of the year from regular budgets, and commingling war and non-war appropriations. And this means that the wars have been funded entirely by what's called emergency supplemental appropriations and contingency appropriations. And there are two salient features of these. First of all, no one has to make any trade-offs, because these are not part of the regular budget caps, which means neither the public nor the Congress has to actually trade off the money against anything else. And secondly, it means that this does not require the same level of budget justification that regular budget submissions require. So the level of detail about where the money is being spent and what it's being spent on is much, much less rigorously provided in these kind of supplemental appropriations than in anything else. In addition, and this is a very critical point, a very large percentage of the war activities have been fought using contract support. Contractors have, in most of the years since 2001, outnumbered actual troops. The contractors mean that the only way to get basic information that would be usable for accountability is in the details of the contracts. And unless contracts are written in such a way to provide that level of detail, it obscures the ability of the accountability agents to actually track where money is going. So the third part of my prong there in the weekend oversight is that I am arguing that the combination of the fact that the budget justification materials were not created in the first place in the budget process, the fact that the budgets were co-mingled between the regular and the emergency and the supplemental budget requests and buried in thousands of individual line items in the defense budget, and the fact that so much of the war was carried out through contractors, created a situation in which our nominal accountability agents, such as the Congressional Budget Office, the Inspector Generals, the GAO, and so forth, were not able to do their job because they really didn't have the inputs that would have enabled them to provide the right amount of oversight. And those of us who have studied the history of trade-offs between national security and secrecy know that the scholars who have studied this for years always point to oversight as being an absolutely critical component of trying to balance those two needs. And here we've had a lack of oversight as well as the breakdown I mentioned. So I know I'm running out of time, so I'm going to skip my next couple of pages here. But just try and talk about what the outcomes of all this has been. Obviously, one of the outcomes has been that the war costs have been deferred to the next generation, adding trillions of dollars to the national debt. Another outcome of this, in my opinion, is that we really have never had a national debate. Unlike previous wars, there has been no national debate about who should shoulder the burden, how the cost of this war should be paid for. And of course, as the costs have been buried to a large extent, the costs that Congress are actually voting on have understated significantly the true cost of the war. The impact in many areas has been an enormous burden on veterans because of inputs not being created related to the amount of authorized benefits for veterans of these wars. We have significantly underestimated the amount of money that would be required to treat veterans for these wars. As you know, I've written broadly on this, but the bottom line is that we have, in addition to having raised the VA budget, which is the fastest growing budget in the federal budget now, from $50 billion to $185 billion over the past decade, we also have at least $1 trillion in accrued veterans benefits that have been promised. And like in previous wars, these are benefits that will come due in 30 or 40 years, but there's no mechanism, no provision anywhere to pay for that, effectively, that additional entitlement program. So finally, what does all of this mean? Why has it happened? I've tried to think deeply about how it is that we have had such a distortion of standard principal agent theory, where the agent, in this case, has of being the agent being a combination of the executive and congressional branches of government, have created a war and hidden it from public view. I've thought about whether it has something to do with fear, whether it has something to do with the way that we interact with the military today, whether it is mostly to do with the draft, whether it has more to do with a change of balance within the military itself, where the military has effectively lost control of costs through the reliance on contractors. I put these out as discussion points for the audience here today, and I thank you very much for your attention. I hope this was thoughtful and provocative. Thank you.